The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Fourth Circuit. We are ready for oral argument in our first case, United States versus Moore. Mr. Barger.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is David Barger. I was one of the trial counsel below, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here this morning to speak with you. Perhaps I'm a little bit of a tax nerd, but who would have thought that a criminal tax case might be a little sexy? And this one may fit that bill. However, having said that, as a practitioner of criminal tax cases for almost 30 years, 16 years as a federal prosecutor, 13 years as a criminal defense attorney, I do understand that a defendant doesn't have a right to a perfect trial. He does, of course, have a right to a fair trial. And my argument, in part, is that the cumulative effect of the failures by the IRS agent and the rulings by the court, in this instance, denied Mr. Moore a fair trial. There are a number of arguments that are addressed in our brief. In fact, perhaps we have too many appellate issues. Some of those I won't get to. One of the ones that I'd like to address, and I don't want to, by picking it first, I don't want to delimit the seriousness for example, our argument about the overbreadth of the search warrant. But one of the sexy issues to me are the two issues involving the $192,000 that the IRS agent at trial failed to credit Mr. Moore, except to the point of $92,000 when I essentially browbeat her into having to acknowledge her mistake, and the $359,000 of deposits Mr. Moore made into his business between 2003 and the end of 2004, which are separate from and before the tax years. You may recall the tax years are 2000.
Mr. Barger, could we start with the 359?
Yes, sir.
What is it exactly that you have a problem with? And more particularly, what are you saying about that $359,000?
Here's what I tried to say and perhaps failed in doing so, and maybe it's a function of having done this so long, things I think are obvious to me.
Well, I'm not so sure that's true. What seems to be true is that you and the government are like two ships passing in the night.
Yes.
Over this $359,000.
That's troubling, Your Honor. That's troubling that a 20-year experienced IRS agent whom I know.
I was talking about the appellate briefs, not the agent.
Yes.
But go ahead. What are you saying about the $359,000?
That $359,000 was not income. The government admits that. That money came in the earlier years. That's money Mr. Moore put into his business. Schedule C business, solely owned by him, not a corporation, not an LLC, very informal form. When he puts that money into the business in the prior years, that's either a contribution to capital, a term we would often use if it's a corporation, and I issue shares.
But it's not a corporation.
No, that's correct. It's simply his business that he put money in. So it could be a loan. There aren't any loans.
When you say he put money in the business,
yes, sir.
It was his money and he spent it however he chose to.
That's correct. But he put it into the business, which meant it was a credit to the business's assets that he could then that the business
gets. And what's your authority for that? What's your authority for the assertion that money expended by a sole proprietor years before somehow have any currency, to coin a phrase, in the tax year at issue? I'm just not following that.
The government commenced
its analysis in July of 2007. Excuse me, July
2005. Yes, sir.
Under the government's approach to the case, that was the moment in time when it was important to know how much cash Mr. Moore had available to him, correct? I mean, you don't dispute any of that, really, do you?
That what you're saying is correct in terms of determining, well, I will say that the judge was wrong in giving the jury instruction about the bank deposit.
Okay, I don't want to take you to jury instruction. I just don't understand the point you're trying to make about the $359,000. Okay. He had it, he spent it, however he spent it. He didn't claim any deductions on any tax returns relating to that $359,000. The government doesn't count that as income. So I'm not
correct. You're correct. Right. He doesn't take a deduction. He couldn't take a deduction because it was a contribution to the business. You're correct. The government doesn't count it as income because it wasn't income in 2005 and through 2007. It wasn't income, but it was a contribution to the business. Think of it this way. If he had set up a corporation.
But no, I don't want to think of it that way because he didn't. once you start asking me to hypothesize all the things he could have done, then it's a totally different case.
No, sir, it's not. Respectfully, okay. If I contribute my money to the corporation.
But it wasn't a corporation.
But he contributed to his business. He's entitled to, think of it this way. Okay, he put the money in. Could he have taken the money out since he put it in? Yes, sir. Once he put it in, he could have taken it out. Okay, it's not a corporation. But once let's say he loaned it to his business.
How is that any different? He owned the building, right?
Yes.
Lived
yes,
upstairs.
Yes, sir.
Ran his business downstairs.
Yes, sir.
How does your argument differ from an argument that says, well, you know, Judge, in years 1999 through 2004, he could have taken depreciation on the building and thereby reduced his income tax, his taxable income and his income tax. Is that any different from
yes,
the
sir.
Argument you're making now?
Yeah, it is different.
How is it different?
There is authority for the proposition that we take the individual as we find him. So if he didn't take a deduction that he could have taken, in criminal tax cases, they'll usually give it to him. But I agree they don't necessarily have to give him a depreciation deduction that he didn't otherwise take. But when you're doing a criminal tax computation, in my experience, they usually do. But the reason that's different is if he had documented his infusion of money into the business.
There you go with if again.
Well, Judge Payne found, Mr. Barger, I find he didn't loan the business money because I didn't see any loan documents. But I can loan my business the money without having documentation. That's a factual finding. But going back to your point that it's not a corporation.
When you pause for breath, I have a question.
Sorry. I didn't want to ignore Judge Davis's question.
By all means.
Yes, Your Honor.
Please go ahead, Judge. No, go ahead, Judge Duncan.
I apologize if I'm talking too fast and too animated.
I have a problem that is a little different. Twofold. One, it seems that July 28, 2005 was sort of ground zero for purposes of the government's analysis of the bank deposits method.
Yes, Your Honor.
Correct. So what the government did is it says that, and it makes some sense. Now you can quibble about the date, and that's a separate issue. Why begin it in the middle of a year? But setting that aside, the government says that its analysis relies on deposits attributable to ATM withdrawals to calculate the amount, which didn't include the 359 because it occurred prior to the date on which the ATMs were installed.
Yes, ma'am.
That's one problem.
Yes.
Bear with me. And even let's assume that you explain that, it still doesn't seem to me to help you very much because that's only the indirect method of proof. The bank deposits method is only the indirect method of proof on which the government relies.
Correct.
It doesn't even touch the specific items of proof, such as the testimony of witnesses about the discrepancies in the amounts on the daily sheets and what would have been generated on high volume days, et cetera, et cetera. So my question is twofold,
right.
And I'm sorry to hit you with a composite
That's
question,
all right.
But I decided to take advantage of
my
window.
Yes.
And if you need to, I'll go back over it. But those are my two concerns following up on Judge Davis's questions.
I may forget the second one, and so I may ask you to give me a brief reminder on that. With regard to the ATMs, the reason the indirect method of proof, without getting too involved, is, all right, we look at 2005 and 2007, and we look at money that goes into the business, and we then, is there a source that would suggest it's income? Yes, the gentleman's club. Right? So that's our source of money. And from the deposits into the bank, We then subtract things we know are non-income. And so the IRS agent's argument for why she didn't consider the 359 that I pointed out was that, well, that was deposited between 2003 and the end of 2004. So I'm only looking at deposits that begin in July of 2000.
You don't have a lot of time, and you're spending a lot of the limited amount of time you have remaining restating my question. Why isn't that a fair?
She's wrong because, sorry,
no,
didn't mean to interrupt. She's wrong because the 359, I agree with her. It's not income. She excluded it from her income calculation. It's an investment in the business or a loan to the business for which he gets credit. If I put a dollar into the business, I can take a dollar out of the business if it's from pre-2005 money.
That's not responsive, or at least I'm not understanding it to be responsive.
I don't know how to make it clearer.
Well, let's give you that, okay? Fine, we agree on the bank deposits method. What about the specific, what about the direct method of proof, the specific items of proof?
Yes.
It doesn't go to that at all, does it?
No, the specific items, you're correct. It doesn't go to that at all because the 359 is not income.
Don't go back there. Go forward to the specific items of proof, the witness testimony, the discrepancies, the fees for the lap dances, all of the direct items of proof in the record.
All of that evidence is sufficient evidence to show he had income and that income was otherwise unreported on the tax returns unless you give him credit for the $192,000 mistake that the IRS agent gave her and unless you give him credit for the 359. If you believe I'm wrong about 359, then the specific items method of proof is evidence to show that he committed the tax offenses. There's sufficient evidence, given the fact that I'm the appellant and I lost, there's sufficient evidence for the government, giving them the benefit of all reasonable inferences, that he underreported income. The reason I keep harping on the 359 and the 192 is he had underreported income unless you give him credit for those two items, in which case 2005 is done, not even close, you wipe it out, and if there are $550,000 in error,
well, the 359, because she ultimately acknowledged some of that.
Yes.
So, but your argument boils down to we have to credit the 359, because otherwise.
It's critical. You're right. Otherwise,
your entire sufficiency claim rests on the 359.
I agree, because if you give him credit for the 192. That only drops 2005 to about $30,000, and Judge Payne said, well, Mr. Barger, but that would be enough to be a material false item. Yes, sir, you're right, under the law, that's correct. So the sufficiency hinges on adding the 192 and the 359. You are correct. And I see that I'm not being persuasive. I don't know what else to say, and so I'll move on from that, other than to say, if I loan money to my business, I can take it out, and he put money that was not taxable.
And the problem that I have with that is that a person cannot loan money to himself or herself. This is a sole proprietorship, and I understand why, and I don't mean this as critical,
yes, sir.
But it wasn't a corporation. It wasn't a capital contribution to an entity. He was just taking money out of his pocket, or more particularly out of the safe deposit box, and spending it on whatever he was spending it on. And he didn't document any of it. So I don't see the difference in your argument between depreciation or any other personal or business-like expense that consumed the $359,000.
I understand your position, and respectfully, I disagree.
Okay.
But I think we've both gone as far as I can with my limited time. Briefly on the search warrant.
Mr. Barger,
yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Judge Kane has a question.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
I don't want to encumber you with a question, but how's the 192? How is that newly discovered evidence?
I knew about it. I knew about it. I found it, well, with the help of my investigator. So I knew that fact. What was new is her finally admitting only at sentencing that we were right, and that her insistence in front of the jury repeatedly that I was wrong and that she was right. The concession is what was new, not the fact. And that concession as the trial lawyer was extremely damaging, in my opinion. I mean, I expect better of the government. I know we don't get a perfect case, but I expect better of an agent who did that. And I don't suggest she was perjurious, but it was either negligent or reckless. And we asked him after trial in our post-sentencing memo, please, if I'm right, tell the court I'm right. What did they do? They basically buried it. The agent basically buried it. And that's what I have real trouble with that. I understand there may be
If we accept that the concession is new, isn't it still in the nature of impeachment?
The government makes that point in their brief, and it's a close call, I agree. I don't think it's only impeachment. And all I've got to rely upon is, as the trial lawyer, having done this a long time, it was so critical to my credibility, but I know there's that word credibility, which is an impeachment argument. So there is a portion of that is true, that it goes to her impeachment, but when she concedes only later that she was just dead wrong, I submit, even if it's impeachment, it's one of those rare cases that we have a lack of confidence in the jury's verdict, at least on the first year.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barcher. You have some time.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors. I apologize if I was a little too exuberant.
Not for me. Exuberance is good.
Mr. Severson, am I pronouncing that?
It's pronounced Severson, Your Honor.
Mr. Severson.
It's a common mistake. my name is Joseph Severson. I'm here today for the United States. So first of all, I'd like to address briefly the last point that Mr. Barger, that the court raised with respect to the issue of the evidence being newly discovered. And, you know, and I think here, I mean, he's narrowed this down. He's made a couple of important concessions. I mean, first of all, saying that only the fact that, you know,
the 359 sort of saves is sufficient. We have to credit the 359 to find that there was insufficient evidence.
That's correct. You know, he's admitted that, and you know, I think for the reasons that Judge Davis has articulated, you know, the argument that he's advancing here just simply doesn't have any merit. To the extent that, you know, those deposits were correctly accounted for in the bank deposits method analysis, they were accounted for to the extent that they were deposits into a bank account, so they weren't cash that could be used to fund the ATM machines. And furthermore, I mean, to the extent that the defendant took that money out of whatever accounts that he deposited it in subsequently during the years at issue, that was credited to him as cash available to fund the ATMs, and only the difference was treated as income.
I do have some discomfort or question about starting a tax year in July, because you found it convenient for your calculation purposes to do so.
Well, that wasn't a question of convenience, Your Honor. That was a question of the specific facts of this case.
And what allows you to do that? What is your authority for the proposition that that a tax year is malleable?
It's not that I don't think the government's argument here hinges on the tax year itself being malleable. It was just a question of when the government started to look for, or when the analysis attributed income to the defendant. I mean, selecting that date wasn't arbitrary. That was the date.
It was arbitrary. Okay. I was just asking for your authority for the proposition that the bank deposits analysis does not have to be coextensive with the tax year. Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of any specific case that has supported that specifically, but I think generally, I mean, the bank deposits method here was followed, and the approach here is consistent with the case law
under the bank. The substantive approach, but not, and you seem to be acknowledging this. Not the timing of it.
I'm not aware of any specific authority that has supported that.
Your answer is the ATMs, right?
Well, yes. The answer is the ATMs, and that's what I was trying to get to. I mean, the reason the government chose this date is because that's the date that the ATMs were installed, and the government's analysis only attributed income to the defendant to the extent that there was a deposit in his bank account that went through those ATMs. Defendant was responsible for putting cash into the ATMs. When a customer withdrew that cash from the ATMs, that wound up being a credit to his bank account. And it was only those deposits that were treated as income.
And I completely understand why you did it. I was just curious because normally that isn't how it works. And I was wondering if you were aware of other cases where it had been calculated in that fashion.
Again, Your Honor, I'm not specifically aware of a case that that supports that approach.
Can you get back to Judge Kane's point?
Yes. yes, I can. So I think, you know, it's important that Mr. Bargier has conceded that this evidence, that the only aspect, if you will, of the agent's sentencing testimony is that he is arguing is giving, you know, the basis of his new trial motion, was the fact that it was different from the earlier testimony, that this was a concession, and that this was therefore only impeachment evidence. You know, this court's precedents, you know, make clear that only under very narrow circumstances is evidence that's only impeaching grounds for a new trial. I think the language in one of the cases is that, you know, you have to. There has to be a showing that the witness who's critical to the government's case consistently lied in the past. And importantly, again, I think Mr. Bargier, you know, he conceded in his briefs and he's reaffirmed this here in argument that there's no basis whatsoever for saying that the agent lied here. This was an innocent factual mistake. The mistake consisted in not recognizing that. That the gross receipts figures on the defendant's 2005 and 2006 returns and draft 2007 returns.
No one's saying the agent lied.
Okay.
But the government put one amount in the indictment, conceded to a different amount at trial, and then came up and conceded again to a different amount at sentencing. So how do you respond to the proposition that it's not the figures, it's not the numbers that were new, but it was the concession by the government that was new, and the jury never saw that, never heard that, and if it had, perhaps the government's case would have been viewed in a different light? How do you address that?
A couple of points, Your Honor. First of all, it's important to bear in mind that, I mean, there was a concession when the agent was confronted with this on cross-examination.
A partial concession,
but a concession nonetheless, and a concession in principle that to the extent that these sales and admission tax amounts were not included in the gross receipts that were reported, that should have an impact on her bank deposits analysis. That if in fact those amounts were collected, but not attributable as gross receipts, that would result in a corresponding reduction to the amounts attributable under the bank deposits method. So, she wasn't presented with this until she was cross-examined on it. She tried to look at it over a lunch break, came back with a figure that, you know, she changed on further examination, but first of all, I mean, the principle was admitted to, defendant presented this evidence to the jury as to the full amount of the sales and admissions taxes that were collected and not reported on in gross receipts and the returns. So the jury was fully aware of the evidence of the amounts and the jury was also aware that the agent was at least admitting in principle that if those amounts weren't on the returns, then that they should factor into the analysis. Second, I don't think that there's any basis to conclude that this, even if the jury had sort of, you know, heard this admission in full, that it would have had any impact on the verdict. first of all, you know, as Mr. Barger admits, even taking that full amount into account, there was still significant amounts of income not reported. I think approximately $560,000 total, and significant amounts in each of the 3 years in suit. And second, as Judge Duncan pointed out, there is a wealth of direct evidence of defendant's guilt that doesn't depend on the bank deposits method. He kept a second set of books. These books were discovered when his club was searched, or at least portions of them that he hadn't destroyed. Those books showed that he was significantly underreporting the amounts of cash that he was receiving for lap dance fees and fines that he imposed on dancers who worked at the club. I think the total was approximately $28,000 for the 40 days of records that were available for 2005, and approximately $100,000 for the records that were available for December 2007 and January and February 2008. In addition, there was testimony from six employees who worked at the club. Three of those employees reviewed a summary of the club's receipts of the club's reported receipts of lap dance fees and fines for weekend nights, which were the busiest nights. And they all concluded that the reporting on those was consistently wrong. This was apparent because what defendant reported to his accountant was that on many days he was reporting that didn't impose any fines on the dancers, but the testimony was that he imposed extensive array of fines and that that there was extensive array of fines that was potentially available and that he in fact imposed fines almost on a nightly basis. And second, the witnesses who reviewed that summary, the underreporting was apparent because of the discrepancy between the reporting for door receipts and lap dance fees. The testimony was that the lap dance fees were consistently higher than the door receipts, but that's not what defendant was reporting to his accountant. There was all of that evidence, and in addition, defendant even admitted in his own will that his business netted $1 million a year. He wasn't even reporting gross receipts of $1 million a year. Even leaving the bank deposits aside, there was extensive direct items evidence of defendant's guilt. So the concession couldn't have impacted the verdict regardless. If there are no further questions, then I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Mr. Barger?
A couple of points in response in my limited time. Government said that the agent's errors on the $192,000 were innocent, and I said that the agent wasn't perjurious. You're right. I didn't say the agent was perjurious, but there is no way that I say the agent was innocent. Her mistake, and that's using it kindly, was egregious, and she knew better. She knew better. The government's witness, the accountant for Mr. Moore, took 20 minutes to figure out that it was $192,000. She had those records 3 years. The tax division authorized a 2-year tax case. If she had given credit for that, if she had given credit for the 359, it's doubtful there would have been ever any authorized tax case. She came along and added a third year later on because she realized the case had its problems. So in no way was that mistake innocent. I have a thin reed of credibility with you. I have a thin reed of credibility with the jury, even more so with the jury, especially given who my client was. I promised that jury in the first minute of my opening statement, I'm going to show you that that agent, an experienced agent, had these records for years and years, made hundreds of thousands of dollars of mistakes, hundreds of thousands of dollars of mistakes. She wouldn't admit any of it. Only after lunch when I said, please, go back, check this. She goes, well, $92,000, but I didn't count this and I didn't count this, so it's probably offset. That was critical to my credibility with the jury. That was critical to my client's credibility with this case. And she never admitted it. And the fact that she, I had to drag it out of her at sentencing, I'm troubled by that. And I think the court should be troubled by that. And the argument about the will, very briefly on the will. He says, if the business is run right, you should make $1 million a year. Well, this is an expense, this is a net worth and indirect method of proof and specific items. And normally when you do an indirect method of proof, you do expenditures. Where did all this money go if he was making all of this money? He lived upstairs in the apartment. You see the pictures, in the exhibits. He had a lot of shoes and a lot of shirts. Where'd the money go? Next point that's very critical, Your Honor, you were asking about the ATM machines and the starting point. You're right, Your Honor, that the ATM machines is the answer for when you start counting the income coming into the business, but that doesn't change the government's obligation that in a cash basis taxpayer, the starting point is January 1st, 2005. Why was that important? Why was that important? And this made me realize the mistake I made when I said this is only about the 359. Because if you look at my brief, the starting point, if you had done the starting point correctly, there would have been another $120,000 that he deposited into the business between January 1st and July, which he had to get credit for, regardless of whether it's a corporation or just a regular business. And the agent didn't credit him with that money, so that allowed her to have a starting point that was $120,000 less, and that $120,000 wiped out anything on 2005. Remember, the government started with $100,000, and then at trial it went down to like $50,000. By the time we got to sentencing, it was $30,000. Well, if you gave him credit for the $120,000 on the starting point, that's wiped out. And Judge Payne knew this. He was troubled. He's the one that said, you know, isn't Mr. Barge right? Doesn't the manual say that on a bank deposits method proof we start on January 1st? He started there, but he was persuaded that, no, well, because we're starting to count the money in July, that's where our bank deposit starts. That's maybe when they start counting the income, but that's not where the bank deposits method of proof starts. So it shouldn't be malleable, Your Honor.
Do you have any authority for that proposition other than the manual?
The cases, when I say the manual has legions of cases for when you have an indirect bank deposits method of proof, and they cite to the cases, and I apologize, I don't remember the cases off the top of my head, but there are cases there that support the proposition, this is when you start counting for the bank deposits. The government, they had an easy one here. They got greedy. They shouldn't have changed the standard jury instruction. I don't know why they did it. It was an egregious mistake. And last, even though I've got 2 minutes, I'll be done. The $28,000 that the government makes reference to on this specific items, that's a figure that comes to at sentencing. It had nothing to do with the trial. That's a sentencing argument for why the government got the 2-point bump on tax loss. And that itemization that he's talking about comes from the search warrant, so I would be remiss if I didn't at least reference our argument on the search warrant. And then my argument about 2007, the failure to file Spee's evasion, where while the jury was told don't consider the fact that he failed to file, that's like the elephant in the room. Don't consider the fact he failed to file. Don't consider the fact he failed to file, even though the government charged him with failure to file and additional affirmative acts. They didn't have to charge him that way, but given the fact they charged him that way, when they didn't let me show that he failed to file because his accountant said so, and the government and we had agreed on a methodology to do this in a way that wouldn't, that would be...
Well, the charge wasn't failure to file.
It was a combination of failing to file plus affirmative acts of evasion that constitutes what's called Spee's evasion.
Right, but the charge was not a charge of the misdemeanor failure to file charge. It was a felony evasion charge.
You're right, it wasn't a misdemeanor, but the charge was failing to file and doing this. The indictment language included failure to file. They put in the draft tax return. In fact, in the government's brief, they said, well, we're nice people. We gave him credit for the tax deductions in 2007, even though he didn't file a return.
But what are you arguing? What is your argument here? Are you arguing about the fact that the district court didn't allow you to cross-examine your own accountant? What does this argument relate to?
It relates to 2007 and not being able to prove that his failure to file, which was a component of the charge, wasn't willful, which is willfulness is the same language regardless of whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. So that hurt my defense on 2007. So basically I was
putting... But is that what you would have brought up had you been able to put the accountant
on
the stand?
Yes.
Okay, the only thing the district court said about that is that you couldn't cross-examine your own accountant during the government's case in chief.
That's correct. You're right.
That you would have to do it in your case in chief, not cross in the government's case in chief.
And by the time we got to my case in chief, the government changed its mind and said, oh, well, now that I see the judge is going my way, I object and you can't ask him that. So I didn't.
Okay.
Thank you for your patience
and
your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barger. First of all, the court would like to thank Judge Kane for sitting with us this morning. We will come down and greet counsel and take a brief recess to reconstitute the panel.
This honorable court will take a brief recess.